We have some guests who are with us tonight. We welcome you because I think you're probably for the most part here for your guest of those who are going to be baptized tonight. We welcome you to our service. And I would like everyone to have a Bible in front of them or look on with someone. Turn to the book of Ezekiel, please. To the book of Ezekiel. Turn to the book of Ezekiel, 39, 38. There is a sermon that has been made quite popular called It's Friday and Sunday's Coming. Anybody ever heard that? All right, you know, you can really... It's good preaching stuff. It's Friday and Sunday's coming. It's a resurrection anticipation kind of crucifixion resurrection. I think there would be another way to spin on that. And this is where our passage in Ezekiel comes in. It's Monday and Friday's coming. Monday for most folks means you get up and you go to work and you get back in the harness and you get back in the groove. Thank you, Ray. I appreciate that. Thank you. And you get in the harness on Monday morning, and you work through. Every day has its own personality, but Friday has got its special personality. They have even named a restaurant after it, TGIF. And it's something you look forward to. Another work week is done. It's Monday. Friday's coming. Well, if I had another kind of sermon ready than the one I do tonight, I'd like to play with that a little bit. It's Monday. Friday's coming. What's Friday? I haven't explained my analogy to you. What's Monday? Monday is looking down through the week, where there is responsibility, where there is work, and all of the difficulties and go that goes with it. And Friday is hope, it's relief, it's a break, it's that to which you look forward to in that kind of a work week. Do you know God, through the prophets, has given to us this Monday-Friday theme? It's all over the place in the prophets. Most of the prophets end on Friday. They start out with Monday, but they end up on Friday. That is, there is a real hope. There is that expectation painted in vivid colors by the prophets so that God's people will not simply tread water, not simply accommodate themselves to boredom, but that God's people will see their life as the opportunity of living out that hope. It's to come back full circle on them. This is where we are with Ezekiel in chapter 38 and 39. Now, we've got some guests tonight. And I am fully aware, having been a teacher for a lot of years as well as a pastor, that when you get people in the class who weren't in a passage like we're in Ezekiel 38 and 39... you may wonder what's going on, because it's not an ordinary passage. These chapters, 38 and 39 of Ezekiel, are really coming to a conclusion on an issue that has been developed beginning in Ezekiel 33. And I have I've got something that came to my attention that may help. This came off the cover of Time magazine, 1979. Can you get this? And you can see poised here in the background the Russian bear, looking rather hungrily over the horizon at the crescent of crisis. Iran, Iraq, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Ethiopia, and Israel. I don't have the article that goes with this, so I don't know fully what was in the mind of the writers or those of the editors of Time magazine, but I can tell you this, that God, through the prophet Ezekiel, predicts a time in the future from Ezekiel's day, 585 B.C., over 2,500 years ago, he predicted that one day there would be the movement of a major army, a massive movement of troops under the leadership, the direction of Gog, G-O-G. Gog will be accompanied by five powers that will move in and invade Israel. Look at verses 5 and 6 of 38, and you will see those other powers. They are listed. Now, I do have some help for you. Here is the outline that we used last week. I won't focus our attention on every part of it. But at this point, the point at which I'm directing your attention now, in verses 5 and 6 of Ezekiel, God will invade Israel with an allied force from the north, east, south, and west. Persia. Can I go back to my map? I've got so many transparencies up here, I'm hoping I can get through this and still remember what. I'm going to move back and forth. Let's lay these out. Persia, Iran, Ethiopia, Put, probably Libya, North Africa, further to the west. All of them with shield and helmet. Gomer with all its troops. This would be the area of Turkey, the tribal groups in Turkey, particularly in the northern and eastern portions of Turkey, and Beth Togarma. This would also be in the eastern portions of Turkey, as well as on up into the Ukraine area, around the Black Sea, this entire area. Actually, this touches upon in 5 and 6 of Ezekiel, as well as the reference to the uttermost parts of the earth, the uttermost parts of the north, that takes us up into the Caucasus Mountains. The countries there today are Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Soviet Georgia in this area. But these are places that Ezekiel is identifying that existed in Ezekiel's day. Tribal groups, the northern perimeter, and then he also does say the uttermost part, or you can see this in verse 15. Verse 15 says, "You will come from your place out of the remote parts of the north." And that's language of extremity geographically, so as to set this Gog army in clear location as being extremely in the north. Not Syria, not just the immediate north, and not even in Turkey, but further north. This is why many have been led to believe that on the basis of what is said in verse 2, you still with me? Look at verse 2, Ezekiel 38. "Son of man, set your face toward Gog, of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh," or chief prince, the chief prince, I think is the preferred translation, "the chief prince, Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him." Again, these are places in these northern boundaries, even north of Iraq is up here, and maybe you're not seeing that really well there, so I have another kind of map that ignore the fact that this is the outline of the ancient Persian Empire, but it does give us the geographical layout of these places. These places, Meshach, Tubal, would have been up in this area, around the area of, this is the area of the, the mountains of Ararat, on the border between Turkey and Russia, and in Armenia, and up in this area. Now, what we saw last Sunday evening in verses 1 to 16 was that God, through the prophet Ezekiel, is predicting that one day Israel, when she is living securely, unwalled cities, notice that theme in verse 8 and in verse 11, as well as in verse 14, God the Holy Spirit wants us to key on that fact that Israel will be living in a kind of security, which, and I'm convinced by the context and everything, by everything we've been studying so far, that this is a security that's essentially messianic. Let me explain why I'm saying that. There are two ways you can come at this concept of security here. There are those who say this security is really a false sense of security, which has come as a result of an agreement, a covenant, between Israel and the Antichrist. A covenant will be made, this is given in Daniel 9 and 23 and following, which will provide protection for the nation of Israel, and she will have surrendered her security. Now, I'm not saying that idea is foreign to the Bible with what I'm about to say. I think that's certainly true according to Daniel. And I think that condition will exist in the time of the day of the Lord, in the tribulation. But I have some difficulty with reading that into these passages, verses in Ezekiel 38. For everything we've seen so far in Ezekiel, in references to security, we've seen, what is the context here? What flows into this? Restoration, regathering, Messiah. And Israel is there with the land flourishing, Ezekiel in 34. Now, you'll notice something else that's of interest here in verse 12. We're still looking over our shoulder at what we saw in the first 16 verses before we can launch in and conclude this description of the invasion of Gog, by Gog of Israel. Look in verse 12 of Ezekiel 38. You notice that it describes the purpose of the invasion by saying to capture spoil and to seize plunder, to turn your hand against the waste places which are now inhabited, and against the people who are gathered from the nations, who have acquired cattle and goods, who live at the center of the world. I want to say something briefly about that center of the world statement. We may think we in the United States of America are the center of the world. That betrays our provincialism. I guess it's only natural for those who live wherever they live to think that maybe the globe kind of revolves around them. But when it comes to spiritual geography, we are not the center of the world. When it comes to prophecy, the United States of America is really marginal. Now, there are those who try to find the United States in Bible prophecy. It just so happens that I notice in verse 15, I'm really about two roads off the main road, but I hope you're staying with me. Verse 15, if you'll notice in verse 13 where it mentions Sheba, Dedan, and the merchants of Tarshish. Now, there is a kind of Bible teaching which wants to find United States of America somewhere. And I remember it goes back to May of 1983. I don't have that good a memory. I just wrote it down when I was listening to the radio program. That a particular teacher on that radio program said this, that this is the United States of America when it says the merchants of Tarshish. Well, when one looks on the map, one will find that Tarshish was located in what we know as today as Spain. It was the westernmost region of the Mediterranean world. And I think that would be the reference. Now, let me come back off that road. Let me come back up to the other road, namely this statement, who live at the center of the world. This is a reference to this land bridge, Israel. Palestine, as it came to be known. The Romans so named it, is it after the Philistines, Palestinia. And what this is referring to is Israel's strategic position geographically, politically, economically, and ultimately, spiritually, we'd have to say, or theologically, as far as the plan of God is concerned. And we are to keep this in mind because that is the reference point for the compass. When we think of north, east, south, and west, it's in relation to what God has done and will do in this land bridge known as the modern state of Israel. Now, all of this we walk through in the first 16 verses of Ezekiel 38. We did that last week. Now, let's move forward and see where we need, where we will be going in this next movement in the book. The second movement is this. From verse 17 down through the end of the 39th chapter, in this description of Gog's invasion of Israel, is that God will exalt his name in the judgment of Gog. This power out of from the north, a nation far to the north of Israel, we can say Russia, certainly fits the description with allied powers are with Russia at the time, that judgment will come. And what a striking, vivid picture. Nothing is like it in the book of Ezekiel. Very few things rival it in the Bible except Revelation 19 and Revelation 20. All right, let's walk forward. From verse 17 down through the 8th verse of the 39th chapter, here is the common thought. The movement is this. Gog's invasion of Israel will result in his defeat. That is what is anticipated. Are you with me now from verse 17? We're not going to be able to take every verse, but I will try to seize upon what I think are the critical statements. So watch me. Thus says the Lord God, are you the one of whom I spoke in former days through my servants, the prophets of Israel? Now this gives us a little bit of a problem because we don't have this battle laid out in such definite terms anywhere else in the prophets. But what I do think we have referred to in some other prophets is this. Joel is one. Zephaniah does this as well as Isaiah 26. Let me go back to the Joel passage. You're familiar with that. We've been through the book of Joel. You remember the locust invasion that was used as a means of foreshadowing a coming invasion by a northern army. I think that's what he's referring to here, that it has been already outlined, certainly in some more, not as fully in his detail, but it has been referred to. And it will come about on that day when Gog comes against the land of Israel, declares the Lord God, that my fury will mount up in my anger. And in my zeal, this is an interesting term that he uses here, it is describing the red hot zeal of God for his people, Israel. And he is going to demonstrate his faithfulness in protecting his people, whether it's Israel or the church. In my blazing wrath, I declare that on that day, there will surely be a great earthquake in the land of Israel. Now, actually, what is described here, let me show you something. There are actually five means that God is going to use to interrupt the movement of the Russian bear against Israel with her five allies. Five means. Would a map bring this back to you or help you at this point? Let's keep our eye on the Russian bear. God is going to use five means of arresting this invasion, stopping it cold, and destroying this army. Let me show them to you. The first is at the end of verse 19, the great earthquake. It must be, well, what do we have? 10, is 10 on the Richter scale? What was yours, Eric? The one you got shaken up with, about a 7. He's even got a t-shirt that says this. You know, he was there in San Francisco at the time. Well, this, I would estimate that this one may be about a 10 on the Richter scale because it's going to be so cataclysmic in its effects. An earthquake that God will use to frustrate the invasion of Gog. Come with me down through to verse 21. I'll show you the second means that God uses. Every man's sword will be against his brother. God is going to use confusion, panic, and suicidal conflict so that the army ends up turning on itself. God creates certain psychological conditions among the troops that they lose sight of who the enemy is. You know, this is not, those who've been in combat know that that's not all that hard a difficulty in battle. Given a few complicating factors, maybe like nighttime, maybe like weather conditions, but God will so affect them that they will end up turning on one another. This even happened in the Gulf War conflict, where we were in some places firing on our own troops for various reasons, breakdown in technology or proximity of troops to one another, so on. All right, look at the third reason, or the third means. It's mentioned in verse 22. It's pestilence. This would be disease, epidemics that will sweep on. While we are dealing now with should there be reparations for the Gulf War veterans, should there be, because of some, to this point, still an undefined illness that swept, that's affected. Gas warfare, though that is not the issue here, but some viral or bacterial factors enter in and create epidemics. Then, in the fourth place, it says that into judgment, I will enter into judgment with him, and I shall rain on him. That's number 4. And his troops, and on many peoples who are with him, with a torrential rain and hailstones. So climate, weather, is going to turn on them. The history of battles has also been the history of weather. It's been the friend and it's been the foe. Many, some of us don't remember real well. We know it from our history books at what Dunkirk was like. And actually the weather there became a saving factor for much of the British Army and allowed a movement out off of the continent back to England. And, well, this is going to be a reversal of that kind of thing. It is going to create, I'm also reminded of what happened to the German army at Stalingrad in World War II. When the winter came upon the greatest fighting force in the world, I mean, the German army, you can say what you will about fascism and all of its evils, but they did put quite a fierce fighting machine on the field. But all it took was one winter, and that did it. We could go through a lot of illustrations. Napoleon and his march on Moscow. Well, this is what God's in control of the weather. And he's going to see that Gog meets his Waterloo because God has his hand on these forces that will be arrayed against him. Well, then number 5, it says, fire and brimstone. So God is going to use some kind of celestial flamethrower, bombing and strafing. With the fire and the brimstone, is it going to be miraculous in the sense that just a direct hand of God in bringing, not through any secondary cause like we might say perhaps meteor showers or things like that. I'm not ready to tell you. I just know that the text says that there will be this move, the hand of God using the whatever powers are necessary to use in nature, massive mudslides, floods, celestial catastrophe. I shall magnify myself. All right, there is that picture. Now, come back with me. Let's move forward to verses 1 through 8 of the 39th chapter. Gog will be totally destroyed. I deleted or did not emphasize, go through the question that I raised in with regard to verses 17 to 23. What will be the twofold result of the display of divine power? God arresting the invasion. I should say this briefly. It's going to be to protect Israel from the attempt of Satan, ultimately, to destroy the covenant people. But there will also be a universal recognition of God's sovereignty, which is stated at the end of verse 23, in the sight, I will make myself known in the sight of the nations. And they will know that I am the Lord. All right, coming on now, down to verses 1 to 8. Gog will be totally destroyed. What will this demonstrate to the nations? That he is the Holy One of Israel. Look at this statement in verse 7. See the end of verse 7? And the nations will know that I am the Lord, the Holy One in Israel. Israel will no longer be conquered, no longer dispersed, no longer a byword. God will take a firm hand in protecting his people, Israel. There will be destruction, verse 6, and military devastation on Gog to the extremities, he says, in the coastlands. Those who inhabit the coastlands in safety, they will know that I am the Lord. And in the Bible, that's the farthest region geographically. I mean, it's some geographical shorthand for saying, as far as the ends of the earth will know who I am by what they see. Now, let's take a step forward. Verses 9 to 20. Watch this. It gets more interesting. Now, this is the part that you may have a difficult time with if you've not had supper yet. So, hold on. Here we go. Gog's destruction by God will result in a massive cleanup operation. It will be unparalleled in the magnitude of casualties that are suffered. Gog's weapons will supply Israel with fuel. Look at the statement in verse 9, where it refers to their weapons. I will make fire, and those who inhabit the cities of Jerusalem will go out with this destroyed army, with, of course, all of its unused weapons strewn over the battlefield. That it says that there will be shields, bucklers, bows, arrows, war clubs, spears. For 7 years, they will make fires of them. So they're going to get an unexpected fuel source, compensate for whatever fossil fuel is not providing, and they're going to get that windfall from this battle. Now, there's a question here, and I can't play with it too long. Those of military-minded and those who like weapons and so on, you would probably like to, men might like to play with this a little longer than the women would. What is this? Are we to understand this description here as plain literal or figurative literal? I prefer to use that terminology. Sometimes people put literal in opposition to figurative, and that, I think, creates some confusion. All the Bible is interpreted literally. Some of it is plain literal. Some of it is figurative literal, using figures of speech. Do you understand the issue I'm trying to raise here? You can see is this the language of equivalency? You know what the language of equivalency would be? Well, what this is saying, and those who would, with some skills in knowing the various kinds of modern weaponry, would say, well, there's a Tomahawk missile right there. These arrows. There we are. There is the latest development in missile warfare. So you would try to find equivalency in F-16s, aircraft carriers, missiles, on that shopping list. Or do you take it in a plain literal sense and say, well, they're somehow going to go back to weapons which may seem more archaic, but would have been necessitated because of conditions in the tribulation, and these are actually wooden weapons that are going to be burned. So on. I don't think wooden weapons are out of the question. I'm just going to say it and then leave it. Would that be an unreasonable interpretation, that they would have to go back to some pre-20th century type weaponry? And, of course, in the passage it also mentions horses, and you have cavalry involved. That would there be, could it not be possible that a reversion to more primitive methods of warfare might become necessary or possible due to the catastrophes of the tribulation? It's a thought to ponder and to discuss, but I've got to put it in gear and move to the next. You want to talk about that? If we can conserve time, we can. Kent maybe wants to ask a question about that, so we'll wait till a little later. All right, let's move forward to another issue in this. Gog's dead will require a vast graveyard. Now, I asked the question, where will the cemetery be? But isn't it that the Spirit of God gives considerable time and attention? That the casualties are so great that it takes 7 months. Look at this thing. Well, we have a reference in verse 11 to where it will block. There will be so many bodies on the battlefield that it will block off the passers-by. So they will bury Gog there with all his multitude, and they will call it the Valley of Hamon Gog. That means the valley of the hordes of Gog, the hundreds of thousands, millions. So this valley is going to be clogged with the bodies of the soldiers. 7 months the house of Israel will be burying them in order to cleanse the land. Even all the people of the land will bury them. Move down to verse 14. They will set apart men who will constantly pass through the land. They're going to have to set up squads. These are burial details. Who are employed to search the land to find additional remains. Go about with body bags. Well, actually, it'd be bone bags is what they would be, because you'll notice that reference down the line to verse 15, that when they find some more bones that have been picked over by the carrion, by the flesh-eating birds and animals, that in verse 15 it says that they will come along and they will see somebody's bones and they'll put a marker there, and then those with the bags will come along behind them and they'll set out the burial detail, will set this out. And look, we're not even through with this. This is going to be such a full-time operation that it's even going to create a small town, village, that's committed to this. Look in verse 16. And even the name of the city will be Hamona. Hamona means hordes. So they will cleanse the land. So there's going to be a special town set up for the burial detail, so that they won't have to keep going over long distances. Isn't this incredible? God wants us to see the consequences of his sovereign, omnipotent hand in arresting this final move. Behind the move, of course, Satan himself, God's move against them to destroy them. What valley will this be? I don't know. Some have suggested it is possible the Esdraelon Valley. There is some linguistic issues that I'm not going to have time to get into. I need to probably identify with you what I mean by the Esdraelon Plain. Here, let me just take a moment, please, and explain what that would be. This plain of Esdraelon, which I'm identifying here on this the land of Palestine, runs east and west. It has quite a storied history far as a layout for battles. And this battleground, I think we may call it that, because it certainly is identified with Armageddon, Harmageddon. Here is Megiddo. I stood there looked over the sweep of the land, the best place really to see this, I went up on top of Mount Carmel, where Elijah was, and that's really the best place to get the sweep of this thing. I stood up there in a place, position, somewhere where Napoleon Bonaparte stood. Well, he looked out over this thing, and he said, well, you could gather all the armies of the world on this. What a battlefield this would make. Some have suggested that this may be that to which he's referring, and that it does run from west to east over toward the Jordan Valley, but that doesn't really connect it with the Dead Sea other than the Jordan Rift Valley. So that's not an open and shut case. The best we can do is that this is going to be a valley that is going to be notorious for having been clogged with the dead and the burial details and all that has gone into it. Now, let's come back to where we, with regard to the statement in verses 7. Then it gets gorier here. You thought we'd reached some kind of pinnacle on the gore. Well, here's another level. Verses 17 and 20 call attention to the fact that this is going to be like a sacrifice. See that term used three times in verse 17, then in verse 19, a couple of times. A sacrifice is what? It's where you take an animal and you offer it up to God. In this case, it's going to be people that are going to be offered up to the animals. It's going to be a little reversal of it all. So you get these. Carrion eating birds and animals, and they're going to pick the bones. Look at verse 18. That might be gory enough. You shall eat the flesh, speaking to the birds and the animals, you shall eat the flesh of the mighty men and drink the blood of the princes of the earth, as though they were rams, lambs, goats, and bulls, all of them fatlings of Bashan. Just a note about Bashan. Bashan was the Kentucky bluegrass area for cattle raising in this territory. It's over to the north and to the, well, it would be south and east of Galilee. The animals, the cattle in that area were known to be well-fed and strong. Well, what the emphasis is in this passage is that the birds of prey and the animals of prey will gorge themselves on these bodies strewn over the battlefield. I told you it was kind of gory. Some of you are getting kind of a bad look on your face, so let's move along. Verses 21 to 29. Gog's defeat will have far-reaching impact. So this whole story now comes down to this crescendo, and here it is. Here are the effects of the battle on Israel. In the first place, the nations will see God's glory. That in God's act of omnipotent judgment, coming in to totally destroy the army, Israel doesn't have to engage this enemy in conflict. As a matter of fact, she couldn't because of her living in security without defense. God steps in and does it, and you will see this reference verse 22, look at it there. Well, verse 21, I shall set my glory among the nations. Just go through here and notice this reference to the nations and that God sets his character, the splendor of his perfections is seen by all the nations and they learn from it. And then verses 27 and 28, Israel will acknowledge God's grace and all of Israel's covenants will be fulfilled. When I will bring them back from the peoples, verse 27, gather them from the lands of their enemies, then I shall be sanctified through them in the sight of many nations. Then they will know that I am the Lord their God, because I made them go into exile among the nations and then gathered them again to their own land, and I will leave none of them there any longer. That is the way God is going to bring the curtain down, on his move against those who come against him. And why do the heathen rage and imagine a vain thing? Coming against God, they're going to meet their Waterloo. Now, let's tie it together. And I've been able to move along with a little bit better, more speed than I thought I would, we're going to have some time for a few questions. And let me tie it together. Let me put a few postage stamps on this before we mail it. So here we are. Let's do it this way. Israel will be regathered to the promised land. Okay? That's been the resounding issue from 33 on of Ezekiel. God is going to see that it will come to pass that wherever Israel has been scattered, she will be brought back. Deuteronomy 30, verses 1 to 6. Now, I can't turn to these passages because we're going to go to some questions, so I have to delete something, and it's reading these texts, but they're very well, they're explicit. The second factor that we need, I'm not going over the boundaries of the land at this point. If you want to ask a question regarding that, we can do that later. But I want to go to a couple of issues here briefly. That Israel's return to the land will be certainly under God's sovereign direction, but this is quite interesting to notice. God will use human means to get Israel back to her land. Let me show you a couple of passages. Look in Isaiah 14. Hold your place here in Ezekiel. Let's roam over to Isaiah 14 and verse 2. How will Israel get back to the land in that day, in messianic times? Now, I'm not talking about Israel's return to the land today, and I'm not talking about the movie, the book Exodus, and all of that. I think that's significant, but that's not fulfillment of this prophecy, okay? And you get illustration from it, but what I'm showing you here is something yet to come. Look in Isaiah 14, 2. Here, context is God bringing Israel back to her millennial experience, restoration, regathering, and the peoples will take them along and bring them to their place. And the house of Israel will possess them as an inheritance in the land of the Lord, as male servants and female servants, and they will take their captors captive and will rule over their oppressors. That term peoples there is a key. Gentiles are going to aid in the restoration of Israel to her land. What's this going to mean? I think it means that they're going to provide the financial largesse to do this. They're going to provide the money. There will be transportational assistance. Well, let me show you something that's even more explicit than this. Look over in Isaiah 60. Go over toward the end of the book. Isaiah 60 and verses 8 and 9. Same kind of thing. Now, you airline people, don't jump to conclusions on this eighth verse here. This is not a prediction of airplanes. Look, are you with me? Isaiah 60 and verse 8. Who are these who fly like a cloud and like the doves to their lattices, that is, to their nests? This is not airplane travel. But what he's referring to here is the swiftness and the great number of immigrants to the land. It's just going to be unparalleled in history when the Jews begin to move back into their messianic experience when the Lord returns. It's going to be incredible. Right now, there are 14 million Jews around the world. And when they are on the move, surely the coastlands will wait for me, verse 9. The ships of Tarshish will come first. I don't think this is the United States of America. I think what he's saying is the navies of the world will be used to return Israel to the land of promise and to bring your sons from afar, their silver and their gold with them, as at the Exodus. Interesting parallel by way of illustration that when Israel left Egypt. For the name of the Lord your God and for the Holy One of Israel, because he has glorified you. So this thing is going to be, the regathering of Israel is going to be under the hands of a sovereign God using even Gentiles to bring it about. All right, let me cut to the conclusion then. I have to say a couple of things regarding this issue here.
With these promises of Israel being regathered and restored, and the fact that, and it seems to be indisputable, I don't see how you can really read the Bible at face value and not come away with this conclusion. There is a future for ethnic Israel. Now, even some of my all-millennial friends will concede that. all-millennialists are those who do not see any literal kingdom experience for Israel on earth. But I know some all-millennialists concede this, that there is a future for ethnic Israel. What I'm saying is this with regard to the New Testament. Israel's future and permanent possession of the promised land is confirmed by the New Testament. Romans 11:11 through 36. We mustn't forget that though the facts of the land returning to the promised land are not laid out in detail in the New Testament, you must remember what the Bible was of the apostles. What was it? It was the Old Testament. It was not necessary to do so. Sometimes I think my all-millennialist friends become more dispensational than dispensationalist. That is, they've dropped a wall there and said God's through with Israel, and that because these land promises are not restated in the New Testament. Why, it's not necessary. 2 Peter 3, 1 and 2 says, believe the prophets and the apostles. This is a reference to what they believe with regard to the Old Testament. They believe, the apostles believe, those land promises were because they were really an extension of the Abrahamic covenant. Abrahamic covenant through the Davidic covenant to the New Covenant. Now, I've gone as quickly as I can. We've got 2, 3, 4 minutes. And do you want to pursue anything? Any questions? Let's see what loose ends need to be gathered up here. Jeff, we'll start with you. All right. Jeff asked the question. I didn't set him up. This is not a setup. He wants to know, is this the battle that is laid out in Revelation 19? You remember last week that I said that there were a number of views taken as to when this battle takes place. Well, I didn't get to my art department, so I had to take things into my own hand, and I just tried to give you the options here. This is a very difficult question to solve. I have studied Bible prophecy since I was 17 years of age. This was the first area of doctrine that really lit my fire. I didn't know how to study the Bible, but I remember buying a book, Things to Come, by Dwight Pentecost in the summer of 1959. Got it from Scripture Truth Book Company, and I didn't even want to go to work that summer. I just wanted to sit there and study prophecy, because I had to. But so I'm saying that for this reason. I've spent a lifetime working through books of the Bible, looking at this thing from every possible vantage point. And you might have come to this confession that it is very difficult to put these pieces of the puzzle together. I'm not saying it's not solvable, but we do have some pieces of a puzzle that are a little hard to get in place here. Here's what I mean. I'm not questioning that this will take place, it's just when. Some say it will take place at the beginning of the tribulation. Now, this schematic here, a chart, is laid out according to a pre-tribulational, pre-millennial view of prophecy. So you make the adjustments if you lean in another direction. But this, some say that it takes place there. I can't counter these. I can tell you places to go if you want to go into. I think there are good points to counter that make that, I think, probably a weak position. There are those who say, follow the dotted line here from Ezekiel's prophecy, some say this occurs in the middle of the tribulation. Dwight Pentecost, many like him have followed this view, and therefore they read Ezekiel 38, with Israel dwelling in the land safely, they say that that is the covenant that they, because of the covenant with the Antichrist in Daniel 9 and 23 and following. There are others who say that this comes at the conclusion in chapter, at the conclusion of the tribulation, prior to the return of Christ to the earth to set up his kingdom. And they and there is a good parallel here to Revelation 19. There really is. I mean, you get an actual literary tie-in by quoting some of the very language there. I can't, time's not allowing me to go to Revelation 19 and 20. If we did, so please, you'll just have to check that out for yourself. Then there are those who say that, and there are a number of interpreters who say this is referring to the passage in Revelation 20, verses 7, where it does mention Gog. As a matter of fact, the only other place outside of Ezekiel where Gog is mentioned is in Revelation 20 and 7 through 10. Which is at the end of the millennial kingdom, according to a premillennial scenario of events, which would be the time when Satan is released, he's deceived to come back and deceive the nations, and then we move there to the great white throne judgment. All right, I still haven't answered your question. I've just shown you what the options are. It's going to have to be either here in 19 of Revelation, or 20 of Revelation, maybe both. There are some who say it refers to both, the Ezekiel passage, and I'm a little queasy about using this term double fulfillment as you get into some hermeneutical problems, but is this a prediction of what will really be, as far as the Bible sees it, a one event separated by, say, 1,000 years or less than 1,000 years, because you get the destruction of the armies, but it's not a complete destruction in 19, and then this whole thing is reopened again at the end of the millennium. All right, I'm having to really be general with this, but it's probably about as good as I'm going to get with it tonight. All right, Steve Sprunger. Here's a man who has years of experience in studying the Scriptures. All right, great. Okay. Some use that as a means of predicting this. Yeah, I'm familiar with that. With that idea. The problem with that view of taking it as the tribulation is that here you get into the tribulation events with what Israel will experience in terms of catastrophe and all. Just take the seven seals, the seven trumpets, and the seven bowls, and all that Israel is involved in terms of judgment and death and warfare. And see, we haven't even factored in Armageddon yet. And we have got another invasion described in Daniel 11, which is the invasion, which I do place here in the middle of the tribulation, the king of the north. Now, that's another dimension. With the king of the north and the king of the south, probably the Pan-Arabic bloc that comes into the picture here. You know, what you come away with in this, the more I look at it, is there is this this Armageddon thing. I'm just limiting my thoughts to this time frame, tribulation. Armageddon's a campaign. It's a series of battles, not just one-pitched battle, with a culminating battle which is concluded by the return of Christ described in Zechariah chapter 14. Well, that is appealing, and others have, just reading this afternoon, someone was using that seven to try to make that point. But that's a good observation, though. I mean, it's something that would make you want to look twice. All right. Yes, all right. Mm-hmm. By just marking them out, just to let the ghost coming along behind them. Well, they got to cleanse the land. Now, you must remember the necessity of making sure there's a proper burial and disposal of bones. This is very important in Judaism, is today. And These would be Jews who are doing this. They're involved in this burial detail, cleaning up their land. God's protected them, and they come out and set up the burial detail. All right, yes, Ellis. Now, here's a man who's been to seminary, so he's probably going to have a real curveball for me here. That's a good question. Yeah. Good question. Why? Here's this question. Why would Russia be interested? What is it that is so seductive about this area? Well, who was that? Oil? Yeah. Well, that's the way it stands. Oil would be. I know Hal Lindsey in his book, The Late Great Planet Earth. He goes through some of the allurement of the North. He mentions the fact of the wealth of the Dead Sea. The mineral deposits in the Dead Sea area alone are worth in the trillions of dollars. Well, there's no oil in Israel. It would be other places. There is the design set on North Africa. That seems to be the interest of the King of the North in Daniel 11. That he's looking beyond the land bridge Israel down into North Africa and to the treasure there. Some have suggested a warm weather port. Some have suggested what did we mention? Oil, maybe in the Middle East, and Israel just happens to be in the way. You can't rule out just the hatred of Israel and seeking to eliminate them as a threat with their they won't have nuclear weapons at that time. They'll be living in safety. What's going to be the enticement at that point? That's about as good as I could get with that. If you want to go through some of the possibilities, you could go back and get your old copy of The Late Great Planet Earth. Hal Lindsey does have a good summary of some of the possibilities there. Though Hal Lindsey equates Ezekiel 38 and 39 with the Battle of Armageddon in the middle of the week. He takes the Pentecost, I think that's Walvoord's position. Hal Lindsey's a Dallas grad. You would expect that to probably have been his preference. All right. Ken. Okay, he was. So what you're saying is that Jonah was actually trying to get to New York City, huh? Okay, I think we'll close on that one then. All right, if Tarshish is the USA. Well, beloved, where we move next is seeing what the Lord has set for his people when the land opens up for the kingdom. We go now into Ezekiel 40 through 43. Now, if you think this has been difficult, well, hang on for 40 and following. It really gets quite fascinating. Let's thank the Lord for his great salvation in Jesus Christ. Father, thank you for the hope that we have of the return of your Messiah, the Lord Jesus Christ. Father, move us to live like people who have hope, not people who are bound up with the times, the tyranny of the urgent, but people who live knowing that your kingdom will come, your will be done on earth.